Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for June 2012. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. Judges come and judges go, and such has been the case in recent years in England. And as the judges change, so too does their perspective on the law. Trevor Cook is a partner in the Bird & Bird Intellectual Property Group in London, England, and is co-head of their International Life Sciences Sector Group. Trevor was named by Who's Who Legal for the seventh consecutive year as the top patent lawyer in the world. Trevor recently wrote a comment for Who's Who Legal entitled, English Patent Litigation, Under New Management, in which he discusses the changes in the English judiciary and recent UK case law. I spoke with Trevor from his office in London, England. Hello, Trevor.
Hello, Don. It's good to talk to you.
We've seen some recent judicial changes in the UK courts that deal with intellectual property cases. Let's run through the players and discuss the impact that their comings and goings have had on the courts. The first is Lord Hoffman, who retired in 2009. Is it an understatement to say that he left behind a pretty big hole?
Well, I think even though our House of Lords, now replaced by the UK Supreme Court, has not heard that many intellectual property cases over the years, he has been the dominant force in the House of Lords for well over 10 years, probably more like 15 years. And he heard all those cases which went up there, and he formulated the legal principles in just about every area of patent law. So I think it is really quite a change. Whether it's left a big hole, we shall have to see. We'll have to see how the replacements fit in. But he was certainly a very, very important figure, and I think his judgments are always highly regarded. They read beautifully. As a practitioner, I might say they're sometimes a little difficult to apply to actual real life situations, but he has really put his mark on patent law over the last 15 years or so.
Lord Neuberger, who was in the House of Lords, is now Master of the Rolls, the head of the Court of Appeal, but he still sat in on the Supreme Court decision in Eli Lilly and Human Genome Sciences in 2011. How does that work? Will he or can he return to decide patent cases in the Supreme Court?
Yes, he can, basically, because once you've been a law lord, once in the House of Lords, you've been a law lord, and once you've been Supreme Court Justice, I don't think that's changed from that point of view, you are always entitled to continue to sit in the House of Lords as was, and the Supreme Court as is now. So I think we might continue to see Lord Neuberger sitting in the Supreme Court, and as you say, he gave a decision in the Eli Lilly Human Genome Sciences case, one of the two lead decisions, I would expect to see him giving decisions in the future. I mean, I think it's quite interesting in that case that actually the other lead decision was given by a Supreme Court justice with very little background in patent law, that is Lord Hope.
Are we already seeing some judges taking the lead on IP cases? For example, Lord Hope gave the other main judgment in the Human Genome Sciences decision, and Lord Mance and Lord Walker in the last House of Lords decision in generics against Lundbeck.
Yes. I mean, the generics and Lundbeck cases are slightly odd situation, in which Lord Hoffman did not sit in the House of Lords because on that occasion he had gone down to the Court of Appeal to sit as a Court of Appeal judge. You then had, and you know, it may have been a dry run, if you like, for when the when he retired, you had the House of Lords without Lord Hoffmann giving judgments on this particular issue. I have to say, in the Lundbeck case, I don't think the combination of the various judgments in the House of Lords actually did much for the clarity of the principles which were an issue. It was a sufficiency case, about the antidepressant drug escitalopram. But I think from the point of view of the clarity of the law, it would perhaps have been rather better had things been left with the Court of Appeal judgment of Lord Hoffmann and Lord Justice Jacob. But I mean, one thing which did, I think, rather surprise me, actually, and also surprised me about the Human Genome Sciences case, was that judges with relatively little background in intellectual property did actually express some quite, or gave some quite thorough, detailed speeches. And so that would be Lord Mance and Lord Hope, who, as I say, I don't believe have a great deal of background in that. The other law lord who continues to sit as a justice of the Supreme Court, Lord Walker, does actually have quite a background in intellectual property. I remember I had a case, designs case, in front of him when he was a first instance judge, and he's continued to hear intellectual property matters. So I would have expected to see him being more active than in fact he has been.
In the Court of Appeal in 2011, Lord Justice Jacob retired. Does that leave another big hole, or will he be coming back to occasionally sit on cases?
Yeah, well, he's entitled to sit for a few more years if they ask him nicely. But of course, now he's got another career as an academic. He's a professor at UCL, University College London. In fact, in terms of judges becoming professors, I should also mention that Lord Hoffmann is now professor at Queen Mary University of London. So both of them have gone off to be professors. But I think Robin Jacobs' role as a professor will actually involve him in quite a bit of teaching activity and so on and so forth. So I don't expect him to sit too much longer in the Court of Appeal. And I think to some extent it was a transitional thing whilst appeals against Lord Justice Kitchen's judgments were going up to the Court of Appeal. Obviously, Lord Justice Kitchen, David Kitchen, couldn't sit on appeals against his own judgments. So I think that was mainly a transitional thing. You ask whether Robin Jacob left a big hole. Yes, but we still hear an awful lot of him. He's still out on the circuit, very much expressing his views in his usual forthright fashion.
We've seen some changes in the High Court as well. Mr. Justice David Kitchen, who previously had been an IP barrister, was appointed to the bench in 2005, replacing Mr. Justice Hugh Laddie. He's now taken Sir Robin Jacob's role in the Court of Appeal as a patent specialist. And in the High Court, Justice Kitchen's spot, along with Justices Floyd and Arnold, has been temporarily filled by Judge Burrs of the Patton County Court.
Yes, he's been acting as a deputy High Court judge in a number of patent disputes. I mean, other judges, there are a couple of other Chancery judges who are nominated also to hear the slightly less technical patent disputes. And in our system, you can also get senior QCs sitting as deputy judges as well. So I think, you know, there's quite a lot of judge power there, but I think there is an expectation that sooner or later a new first instance patents judge will be appointed to join the existing first instance patents judges. That's Sir Christopher Floyd and Sir Richard Arnold.
Now, I know that one data point does not a graph make, but what, if anything, can be extrapolated from the only decision to date from the UK Supreme Court, the Lilly and Human Genome Sciences case?
Yes, it's a slightly strange case. I mean, I don't know how... I should fill in some of the background to it, because it is it was a patent which emerged out of sequencing, gene sequencing being undertaken in the mid-90s, and determining homologies with known of proteins which emerged from this with known proteins, and then speculating on the basis of this as to what potential utility such a protein might have, but without any actual real data or biological data as to what the protein actually was responsible for. And it's a bit unfortunate, actually, the way the sort of procedural posture of the case, because at first instance, the patent was found invalid because of its speculative nature, not only for lack of industrial applicability, but also for insufficiency and for lack of inventive step. Unfortunately, in the Court of Appeal, they only really addressed the lack of industrial applicability argument, and not the other ones, which I think in many ways have more applicability to this sort of situation. I mean, as a practitioner myself, I was brought up to think of lack of industrial applicability as being a ground of invalidity which never really applied in practice. It was the sort of reason why you couldn't patent perpetual motion machines, but that was about it. It had no, if you were getting into patent litigation, it had no relevance, because by its nature, something that is patented and is worth litigating about must have industrial applicability. So it was a little weird that there has been this concentration on this particular ground of objection. And so it is, I think, a little unfortunate that the first outing of the Supreme Court has been to address it. But I think they did the right thing by effectively putting it back in its box and saying it has no real application in a case like this, where and they gave a very useful checklist of how you deal with industrial applicability in the context of these sort of gene patents. But there again, I mean, that's a historical issue. These emerged out of a sequencing activity in the mid-90s, and I don't think it's going to be too much of a problem going forward and in the future. It'll be interesting to see, actually, because the litigation isn't concluded, because, as I said, the House of Lords, the Supreme Court effectively only dealt with the industrial applicability point. There are some sufficiency and inventive step issues also to be argued out, and I understand those have gone back to the Court of Appeal to complete the job it failed completely to undertake last time round.
There is a pending case before the UK Supreme Court, the Virgin Atlantic against Premium Aircraft Interiors. I understand that was a patent case where a trial was held, the patent was found to be valid and infringed, and a reference was ordered to determine the damages owed by the defendant. But in another proceeding dealing with the same patent, that patent was declared invalid as against the entire world, and the court has to decide what to do with that reference for damages.
Yes, it's a problem one has in most jurisdictions, but it's a particular problem in Europe because, of course, you know, patents can get invalidated in national proceedings, but also they can get invalidated as a consequence of an EPO opposition. And it is the effect of a judgment which has said that a patent is valid and infringed, a judgment from which there is no particular appeal that a patent has been a patent is valid and infringed, and the effect on that of a subsequent determination that the patent is in fact invalid. The traditional view of the English courts has been that a judgment is a judgment as between the parties, and if you have been ordered to pay damages, even under a patent, even though it is later determined to be invalid, then that is hard luck. The whole judgment cannot be reopened. It continues to apply as between the parties. They don't go as far as to say that an injunction should continue in those circumstances, but certainly they've traditionally, and for well over 100 years, taken the view that the damages are payable. It's quite interesting in this particular case that it has gone up to the Supreme Court, because there was a case a few years ago where this was argued, a Coflexip case, and in that it went up to the Court of Appeal, and David Neuberger, then sitting as who was at the time in the Court of Appeal, he actually gave a dissenting judgment disagreeing with this long-established principle of patent law. So it'll be very interesting. So one might expect to see him back in the Supreme Court and perhaps developing the line of argument that he developed in the Court of Appeal there. And so it would seem that there must be a real prospect of this principle being reversed.
Thank you for these insights, Trevor.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, Don. I thoroughly enjoyed talking with you.
Trevor Cook is a partner in the Bird & Bird Intellectual Property Group in London, England. For further information on Trevor Cook, his firm Bird & Bird, and for a link to Trevor's comment entitled English Patent Litigation Under New Management, and for information on our other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You've been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.